Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, secret societies, and many of the ancient occult and esoteric mysteries. My name is Mark Amaru Pinkham. I am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Knights Templars, which was founded to revive the esoteric mysteries and rites of the original Templars. You can learn all about our Gnostic Templar Order at our website, which is www.gnostictemplars.org. And while you're there, you can sign our mailing list and receive our monthly e-newsletter. And you can also become an associate member. And if you want, you can even download an application to become a full initiated member. Our next initiation ceremony will occur here in Sedona, Arizona, next March 2012. So if you are interested in being part of that ceremony, you might want to submit your application very soon. Today, we're going to be discussing a most fascinating place known as America's Stonehenge. This is a very ancient megalithic site that I recently visited with my wife, Andrea, during a visit to New Hampshire to visit my family there. This site is formerly known as Mystery Hill, so some of you might recognize it by that name. But today, American Stonehenge is this amazing site that consists of many standing stones and stone enclosures that date back to apparently at least 2000 BC. Now, over the years, this site has been occupied by the Phoenicians, the Celts, and apparently even the Hebrews. It's one of many similar sites you can find in the northeastern part of the United States, which apparently seemed to prove conclusively that America was discovered and inhabited many thousands of years before the arrival of Columbus. Now, our guest today is Dennis Stone, who's the president of America's Stonehenge. Dennis has been involved with America's Stonehenge, which is located on his family's land, for most of his life. His father, Robert Stone, opened American Stonehenge to the public in 1958. Now, Dennis has always had a fascination with archaeology and archaeoastronomy, and he's taken numerous courses and traveled extensively to the ancient sites, both in the U.S. and internationally, to study their alignments and study perhaps their link and connection to America's Stonehenge. Dennis's hobbies include caring for the magnificent alpacas that you can see when you visit America's Stonehenge. For more information about the location and hours of America's Stonehenge, as well as a lot of the history, you can visit its website, which is www.stonehengeusa.com. That's www.stonehengeusa.com. So welcome, Dennis. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me on your show today.
Yeah, it's exciting having just visited your site to have you on and to learn much more about this enigmatic site that I feel like it's time that the world knows more about it. I'm surprised that they don't know more about it. Having talked to you there and at the site and finding out that it's really not that well known, I was really, really amazed by that. I think I remember telling you at the time that if such a site existed in Europe, there would probably be 10,000 visitors a day to it. So, I mean, what do you attribute to the fact that it's not very well known at this point?
Well, it is a well-kept secret, not to our own doing, of course, but we've been open almost 55 years to the public. And it's a very unusual site. It's controversial, you know, as to what the site's all about, but it has been on many TV shows starting around 1970 with a show by Rod Serling called The Unexplained on NBC and various radio shows and In Search of with Lenny Nimoy back in 76. And it seems like the public will probably, a lot of people would watch these shows but still not really get the connection of what the site might be. And because our history books talk about 1492 with Columbus, and it goes to 1776 and quickly forward. It doesn't really talk too much about the ancient past, and our site certainly we think is part of the prehistoric past of North America. But we just don't have an answer why it's so, you know, such a well-kept secret. You're right, if it was in Europe or maybe if it was out in the Southwest, there'd be many more visitors to this area. But the site probably is one of the oldest man-made stone ruins in North America.
Well, how long has your family owned this property that America's Stonehenge sits upon, and when did they actually realize what they had there?
Yes, my dad first heard about this. He was in the Coast Guard for a few years, right up in Labrador, actually, up in Canada, and he was always interested in the past, starting with Columbus and going backwards. And the Vikings, of course, was something he was interested in. If he had only known it at the time, back in 1952-53, when he was up in Labrador, that the Vikings actually made it to Lonzo Meadow, Newfoundland. He could have gone right over there and visited the site. But it was about 10 years later they actually discovered that the Vikings had, or they had the proof that the Vikings had made it to North America. And a couple of years later, my dad heard it's a big radio station in Boston, and they had a show called Yankee Yarns with Halton Hall Blackington. And they were talking about the site, and he lived only a town away and hadn't heard of it before. And so he mentioned it to my mom, and my mom said, well, I think her sister and my aunt and uncle had been here in the 1930s on bicycles when they were dating, and they picnicked up here like many, many people. It was like a magnet to bring many people up because of the mysterious ruins. People would go up there and picnic among the ruins. Even school kids from a local schoolhouse would do that going back into the 1800s. So they heard about it on the radio, and then right after that he saw in a barbershop, too, an article in a magazine called New Hampshire Profiles, and it was a feature story about these stone ruins. So between the two of them, he went down the next weekend, I guess, with my aunt and uncle and my mom, and as soon as he saw the site, he climbed underneath the chain link fence that's still there protecting the site, and basically fell in love with the site and said someday he wanted to open it to the public. And my mom said something about having rocks in his head, you know, but, and he did, I guess. But that's how he got involved with it in the 1950s. And he was working at AT&T and Bell Laboratories as an electrical engineer at the time, and he stayed there for about 30 years. But this was his passion. He opened it up in 1958 as Mystery Hill Caves. A couple of years later, they dropped the word caves in 1963 to just Mystery Hill. And the name Mystery Hill is still the name of the hill. It hadn't been named before. Where all these stone ruins, people didn't actually have a name for the hill itself. So it officially became Mystery Hill, and that's on the geophysical maps today. So the name has stuck as far as the name of the hill. But 1959, the year after we opened it, the Saturday Evening Post did a feature story on us, and they kind of compared it to Stonehenge in England, so they kind of nicknamed it Stonehenge of America. So the name kind of was a nickname for many, many years until 1982 when the name changed to America Stonehenge. And that's more to do with the astronomical alignments. The form of the site looks quite a bit different than Stonehenge in England, as you can see, but its function is the same with the seasons and cross-quarter days, and we also have a star alignment and possibly other star alignments at the site. And over time, we found out that it's not the only site, as you mentioned. There are many, many sites in the Northeast. I think today they number close to 800 stone ruins from Canada all the way down to the mid-Atlantic states, and still trying to study who built these sites and what they used them for.
So, Dennis, how large is your family's land that these ruins sit upon today?
Yeah, we have about 106 acres that is protected land, basically the entire top of the hill. The stone ruins where the chain link fence was put up in 1936 by the first researcher, William B. Goodwin, covers about 1 acre. That's where the main stone ruins are. Outside of that, we have about 15 acres of walls with the standing stones for the sunrise, sunset, moonrise, and moonset, and also the star alignment. And outside of that, we have found other, like the glacial cliff shelter, we found Native American pottery out there. Near our parking lot, we found the remains of a wigwam. So the entire 106 acres has a lot of interesting features. And when my dad first started purchasing it, it was in pieces. He bought the land. He wanted to protect the entire hill, and he began buying it in the early 1960s. He actually leased the property for a few years from 58 to 65, and then he started buying out the land to protect it because he knew that the area was developing. A lot of homes were going up, and he wanted to protect it, you know, from development, basically. And in 1970, the state of New Hampshire designated it as a state historic site. But it took a few years for that. But the state recognizes it as a state historic site, but they don't control it or own it or anything like that.
Well, it just really amazes me that a site like that, such an incredible ancient site like that, would ever go up for sale. I assume that the previous owners didn't know what they had there.
Well, actually, the site was first written about in 1907. A gentleman named Edgar Gilbert wrote The History of Salem, and he mentions a strange but wonderful place where weird tales may be woven. And he was aware that the Paddy family had owned the land, and actually going back to 1734, we have a record of ownership by the Paddies. It was a Paddy named Seth Paddy who had purchased it in 1734, and then his son owned it after that, and then the third person, one we talk a lot about, Jonathan Paddy, was there from around 1800 until he passed away in 1849. And it's kind of a colorful figure because he was a tax collector. He took in the slaves from the Underground Railway, and Wilbur Seibert, who wrote of the Underground of Ohio, New York, and Massachusetts. And in the Massachusetts version, he talks about Mr. Paddy and how he would receive slaves from Mr. Poor and a Mr. Hussey at night, and they would help hide them, and then they would go on to Canada through a number of underground railroad stations. And Paddy's also had a lot of the site removed during the 1840s. During the Industrial Revolution, a lot of cities were being built, and they needed material to build these cities. And some of the stones from our site, unfortunately, were taken away, and you can see the drill marks, and you can see the quarry post socket where they put up like a big wooden crane to lift up rocks. And we estimate half of the site was destroyed during Jonathan Paddy's era, and he actually was a tax collector, and he knew that if he didn't quarry the stones himself that they were already previously quarried, he didn't have to pay a tax, so he kept more of the money that way. So he didn't really know what the site was about. It wasn't until 1930s when a gentleman named William B. Goodwin, who was from Hartford, Connecticut, and he was an antiquarian. He was very interested in the past. He wondered where Columbus landed. He did a lot of research on that. And he also was interested in Leif Erikson and Irish Company monks. And when he became familiar with the site around 1935, he visited the site, and he ended up buying the site specifically because of the stone ruins. And he spent the next 15 years researching this site, as well as he photographed and researched about, I think, 15 other sites in New England at the time that he knew of. I think you'd be amazed today that we know of about 800 in the Northeast. His idea was that the site initially was a Viking settlement, but as he uncovered the debris and the brush, all the rubble, it looked more like what he thought, an Irish Caldy monk monastery, 1,000 years old. And these Irish monks were escaping Viking persecution, was his theory. And this is just one of the monasteries that that they built over here, including the Pueblo de the 15 that he was aware of. And he wrote several books, one called The Ruins of Great Ireland and New England in 1946. The Truth About Leif Erikson was another one of his books. And he died in 1950, still believing the site was 1,000 years old. And when he died, he willed it to Malcolm Pearson, who was the gentleman that actually showed him the site in 1935. And Malcolm just died last year. He was 99 years old. And there's a chamber down in Massachusetts called Upton Chamber in Upton, Massachusetts. And a town, I think, just spent $700,000 to purchase the land to protect the chamber. It looks like a passage grave, kind of like an igloo-shaped structure, very similar to some of the other European chambers. And they've named it the Malcolm Pearson or the Pearson Upton Chamber now. So he's getting a chamber named after him, which is kind of neat. But it was his family that had purchased it back in 1925 or 6 when Malcolm was a youngster. And they said to him, young boy, there's a cave out back. So he goes out back and sees the structure, and that's how he fell in love with this whole thing. And even up to his death last year, he was very, very much involved with all these ancient ruins. And then my dad ended up purchasing the site from Malcolm Pearson, so deliberately because of the site.
Well, I'm curious to know if you have encountered any of the local Native Americans, and if they have any references to this place in their traditions.
That's a very good question, because we do know the Native Americans were on the hilltop. We have the pottery that was found at the Glacial Cliff Shelter, which is on the west side of the hill. It's a beautiful area overlooking the Spigot River, which is a tributary of the Merrimack, which is a very large river that runs Massachusetts right into New Hampshire. So in a tributary of that called the Spigot River, which I think is a Native American name, there's a Native American trail that went right along the side of that river on our land called the Pawtucket Trail. In fact, where we live today is on that a road named after that, Pawtucket. On the parking lot side, which is on the opposite side, on the east side of the, down on the lower part of the hill, we found a wigwam site about 30 feet in diameter, and we found grease from cooking, and we found two fire pits. One of them dated 2,000 years old, so we think that was a winter camp, and they would go to the other side of the hill where the Glacial Cliff Shelter is in the summer, where the northwesterly breezes would keep the keep them cool, and because the rivers are used for transportation. But we've heard rumors or legends that Native Americans generally stayed away from the top of the hill. They thought the place was, you know, had some sacredness to it or something, that they probably didn't want to go up there. They may have feared the site. There was a lady named Paula Underwood that wrote a book, I think, about a dozen years ago called The Walking People. She lived in California. She was an IBM consultant. But when she was young, her grandfather taught her oral tradition, because the Iroquois from the northeast. And the tradition talks about something like 10,000 years of history. And when she learned it, she had to learn it several different ways, so she kept the story correct. And part of the story talks about these strange people that had these stone structures on these hills. And she had no idea what it meant, you know, being in California. And it wasn't until many, many years later that she visited New England and became familiar with these northeast sites. And that kind of made sense at the time, that the story, that history that her grandfather taught her, was probably correct, and it talked about these strange people. So apparently it wasn't the Native Americans that directly built the site, but they may have witnessed it. They may have, you know, and it stayed in their tradition for thousands of years. So that is a very good question, but unfortunately most of the Native Americans in this area, around 1620, a lot of them had perished from probably hepatitis B, or some people think it was smallpox that might have killed off most of the Native Americans, as well a lot of the history that they would have. But the little that we do have seems to indicate they're aware of these structures, and that they lived right near our site. We do have a 7,500-year-old fire pit, and the Woodsull Oceanographic Institute did the carbon dating on that back in 1995. And 7,500 years ago, somebody was building a campfire on the hill. So I think you mentioned earlier, it's kind of a layering, what we call it, the layering of cultures. It goes from that time period all the way up to the Patty family, and today we have it open as an open-air museum to the public. So there's many, many different uses of the property over thousands and thousands of years.
Well, I know you've done a lot of research since your family acquired America's Stone Inn. So, you know, what have you found out in terms of what cultures may have built this place or lived in it, and how far back are we going with this?
Well, the 7,500-year-old dating, probably Native American at that time period, and then the earliest cabin dating we have on the main site, and the main site, again, is that one-acre area where most of the stone structures are located. We've taken 16 cabin datings on the hilltop, but in the main site, that one-acre area, we have a 4,000-year-old cabin dating, and we have the astronomical survey that was done from 1973 to 1977 by professional surveyors. They surveyed the stone markers, and we had we were aware of him in 1930s. In 1965, a CBS special called Stonehenge Decoded came on, and also the book by Gerald Hopkins called Stonehenge Decoded. And it kind of got our interest because you're wondering what these standing stones were around the perimeter of the hilltop. What function would they serve, if any? And so we began clearing trees in 1967, 1970. The weather cooperated for the first time, and we saw the winter solstice sunset over that stone. And I was up there to witness that. We photographed it. My dad, he was kind of an artist. He made a painting out of it. And we realized that we have an alignment. But do we, the other stones also, are they aligned with anything? So we began more tree clearing. And by 73, we realized we had to have a proper survey done on the hilltop. We had to have it accurately, surveyed. And this data was sent to the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in 1977, and they're located in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they put it through their computer to see if the alignments worked. And they surveyed the horizon, the elevation of the hills around here, and they threw that all into the computer, and they said that if these alignments were used for astronomical observations, they would work about 1800 BC, about 3800 years ago, plus or minus about 200 years. And that falls right into the 4,000-year-old carbon dating. So they kind of agreed with one another. And that's due to the Earth's tilt. It very slowly tilts on its axis about 1 minute, about a 60th of a degree every century. It also precesses, too. The 26,000-year precessional cycle changes the seasons and the pole star. So 4,000 years ago, the Earth is tilted differently, and the solstices work. And we also have lunar alignments that worked at that time. We call the lunar major, north and south, lunar minor, north and south. They worked at that time. And a little bit out today, they don't quite work because of the Earth's tilt changing. But today, the North Star, we have a stone pointing at it. It's Polaris. But over 4,000 years ago, it was a star called Thuban. And the Egyptian pyramids and Cheops may be 4,600 years old. They have a shaft pointing towards a North Star, and at that time it would have been Thuban. It's the brightest star in Draco, the dragon. So astronomically, we kind of helped to support our carbon datings, and we had a stonemason. This gentleman spent years in Europe working on historic and prehistoric sites for the British government, and he's a master stonemason. He's got today his doctorate in historical anthropology, and he's a doctor of theology, but he looked at this site as well as other New England sites, and he said that our site, for instance, the stones were quarried off the bedrock. Some of them weigh 8-9 tons. The biggest stone that was moved was about 50 tons. And these big slabs of stone were used for the walls, for the roofs of these chambers, and also for the astronomical alignments, as well as one of the really interesting features in the middle of the site is this big table shaped like a bell. It's about 9 feet by 6 feet with a groove carved on it. He said that the technique used was Stone Age. It was stone against stone used to dress or shape these stones. Metal tools were not used to quarry or to shape these stones. So we have another piece of information that whoever built this was using Stone Age technology, kind of supporting that 4,000-year date. And throughout New England, we have inscriptions. And at our site, we have Phoenician, Bolivian, and Celtic inscriptions, and they go from actually up in Maine all the way down to Brazil. There's some Phoenician writings as well as some of the other ones I mentioned. There are place names all over the Northeast, mountains, rivers, valleys, and gorges. And Dr. Barry Fell from Harvard University, he passed away about 20 years ago. He was an epigrapher, a study of ancient script. And he had the Epigraphic Society, which is still in existence today. I think they had over 1,200 members at one time. But he believed that the markings represented Old World script and would help prove people from the Old World made it to the New World well before Columbus or even the time of Christ. But these place names, he found, were not only Native American, like Merrimack River, Amistig River, Mount Monadnock, Ouatachiche Gorge up in Vermont, Lake Memphis-Magog up in Vermont, and many, many other names. They're not only Native American, but they have a certain meaning behind the name. But they're also Gaelic, or actually Celtic, and with the same meaning behind them. So, like, these words were borrowed or loaned between cultures. So we have that going on, too. And even a Carthaginian coin, because they're the Phoenicians, and the coin that's found seems to show part of Western Europe on the coin, and to the left side of the coin, it looks like kind of a rough outline of North America, which is kind of interesting. So all these little bits of information like that, pieces of the puzzle that seem to indicate old world visitors to the new world going back thousands of years ago.
So has anybody suggested, maybe Barry Fell or another researcher, what culture or what people may have been the original builders of Mystery Hill?
Yeah, it's a megalith. Our site is a megalithic type site, and megalithic sites in Europe go from Ireland, and they head eastward all the way into the Black Sea of Russia, and they're from about the time of the Bronze Age, roughly 1500 BC, although that time period varies depending where you are in Europe, going back to almost 7000 BC. I believe this one of the structures in France called Tumulus St. Michael. A lot of these ancient megalithic sites were kind of Christianized. But this site goes back, I think, about 7,000 BC, almost 9,000 years ago. So it covers a wide range of time and a very large geographical area. These sites, if you look at them, they have a certain, what we call a monumental architecture to them. There's long burrows, round burrows, there's wedge tombs, there's menhirs, which are really long stones stood on end, and there's also monoliths, which are shorter stones stood up on end. Any stone chambers, like passage graves, like what we have at our site, galley graves, and they not only go throughout Europe, but they go into India and China, and South Korea had over 80,000 of these megalithic-type sites at one time, and they look so much like what you'd find in Portugal, Spain, Ireland, or England, or France, or even Germany or Sweden. And then you go into Colombia, South America. There's a similarity again when you look at the megalithic-type sites down there. So they cover a large part of the world, including the Northeast. But the Phoenician writing, the Celtic, and the Libyan writing that were found at our site, Perry Belt Belt, they came from the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, because of the style of writing. It looks more like that than it does from elsewhere in the old world, according to Barry Fell. I guess it changes whether you're in Iberia or whether you're going to different parts of Europe or Africa. It's a little bit different form, I guess. I'm not an expert in ancient writings, but according to Barry Fell, it looks like it came from that area. So it was the Iberian Peninsula. And it was a melting pot. And Gades, Spain, or Cadiz, or however you pronounce it, was also a Phoenician port. And the Phoenicians set up 50 ports for trade all around the Mediterranean and outside the Mediterranean. They apparently went to Cadiz. And they went to other places in Spain and got silver. They may have gone to England and got tin in Cornwall. And in the Baltic Sea, they might have got amber. So they were trading all sorts of goods around the old world. And Barry Fell thinks it continued right into the new world, right out to, in fact, Lake Superior. There's Belle Island. It's a 40-mile long island in Lake Superior. And it had something like a 500,000 tons of copper removed from it. And Barry Fell thinks some of this ended up back in Europe. And he found some of the ancient tools used to extract the copper, and he found inscriptions out in that part of the country also. So these people may have been here for commercial purposes to bring back goods. That's what the Phoenicians were really big into trade. And because we get our alphabet, they had a 22-letter alphabet that the Romans, Greeks, and the Etruscans actually adopted. Today we have a 26-letter alphabet, but our alphabet comes from the ancient Phoenicians originally.
Well, so what could have potentially happened is that Phoenicians built the site, and then later on, maybe the Celts or Libyans or some other people then inhabited it?
That's very possible. They recycled it. They reused it. They may have been coming over to this place for a long, long time. The site may have been used either continuously. We're not really sure about that. Or it may have been abandoned and then reused by other peoples later in time. Verrazano, the navigator that came over in 1524 for King Francis I of France, came over, and he came into North Carolina, went by Chesapeake Bay, Delaware Bay, up to the New York Harbor where they had the Verrazano Narrows and the bridge, that's a beautiful bridge built there, of course. And they went into New York Harbor, spent a little bit of time there, and then he ends up going along the southern coastline of New England up into Narragansett Bay, Rhode Island. And he has a harbor pilot, a Native American, on a ship to help guide him in. And the name of the Native American is Magnus, which is kind of a Scandinavian name. And he mentions that their skin was much fairer than his. They had blue eyes, some had green eyes, and some had light-colored hair. And to kind of support that, Roger Williams of Rhode Island spent, I believe, about a year with these Narragansett Native Americans, and he reported the same thing. And some people think the word Narragansett itself is a corruption of North Gang settlement. So it sounds like some old world people that landed there. They may have intermarried with the Native Americans, and then they went kind of Native in their appearance and in the way they lived, but they had some of the, you know, some of the European blood still in them. Up in Canada, the Beothuks up in Newfoundland reported the same thing. Some had blue eyes, some had, I guess, light-colored hair, and some had fair skin. And also the Mandans out west. So you have, you know, not only stone structures, you have inscriptions, you have place names, you have old world legends, of course, of this land over here. And then you have, it looks like what we'd say, I guess, White Indians. And I have a little bit of Native American in my blood, too, from my mother's side. She had an ancestor that was Native American from Canada. But there was kind of a mixed blood. And so, it's, again, in little pieces of the puzzle, people wonder if the Vikings made it down into New England. And the main, there's a cat called the Maine Coon Cat. The first settler said, gee, it looks like a raccoon. It looks like a cat mated with a raccoon, because it's not possible. But several years ago, they did some study, and they did a DNA test, and the nearest relative to this Maine Coon Cat is a Norwegian cat, and the Norwegians are the ones that basically came across Iceland, Greenland, and into Canada. So the, one of the things they may have left behind was this cat that was on the ship to keep away the rats and mice. It mated with a domestic cat that they say is now extinct in Maine, and when the first European settlers came over, or I should say they came over again in the 1500s, they saw this cat, and they wondered what it was, you know, but it may be the results of the Vikings, actually, even the cat behind. So that's kind of neat, too. So looking at animals, and on the West Coast, the Spanish run into a chicken that was a naked neck chicken, they call it. It has a Latin name. I can't think of it. But it's an Asiatic bird that was already there. Somehow it came across the Pacific before the Spanish got into Southern California. And that was kind of a mystery, too. So they're looking at animals, too, in DNA studies.
Well, I guess one question I have is, of all the places they could have chosen for Mystery Hill, for those stone enclosures, why did they choose the location it is today? And has anyone given that any thought?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Why this particular hill? We're 18 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, and if you look at a map, we're about 40 miles north of Boston. Just south of us, though, about 4 miles away, is the Merrimack River. And then, of course, the tributary goes up right by our site. So if you're coming in from another, you know, part of the world by water, you would, if you came up, you could probably come up the Merrimack River, which is navigable, up to Lawrence, Massachusetts. There's a big dam built there. But if you, right by a town called, a city named Haverhill, Mass., we're only 4 miles from Haverhill, and the river takes a big bend to the north. And if you look at a geological map, it's all swampland between the bend in the river and our site. And we were just getting, we have to do more study. We're trying to find out if that was actually navigable too, and it's just silted in. That's on the east side of the site. On the west side is where that Spica River is, which is a tributary of the Merrimack. The hilltop is probably, might have been chosen specifically because of the astronomical alignments. It, you stood on the top of our hill, and it was pretty clear back then. We did a shovel test pit study. We ran 100 shovel test pits. They're called STPs, and it ran about a 10-year study. They're about 50 centimeter in diameter, and they go down to the hit bedrock, or what we call a preoccupational level. We wanted to map the hilltop for archaeological and geological study. And what we found was, and the President of the Hampshire Archaeological Society was the one that was leading that during the 1990s, and what she found was that the hilltop was about 75% bare. And her husband was a doctor of geology at Tufts University. He'd been there for 30 years, and he was just getting involved with the site. Unfortunately, he passed away from a car accident. He got killed in a car accident. Just as he was getting interested, he had just retired from Tufts, and he was going to do a geological study and answer some of the questions, including was the site navigable from the east side, where it's all swampland down to the Merrimack River. That's one question we had, and also the Spigot River, and also the depth of the river and the river course if you went back 4,000 years ago. But what we did find was the hilltop was pretty bare, and that makes sense. If you have stones, you want to watch the sunrise, sunset, moonrise, and moonset. If you look at the horizon, though, the elevation of the horizon is just a little bit higher than our hill, and it makes for a more accurate sunrise. It's about a half a degree high. It's different than if you go to the ocean where the sun's rising and the moon's rising on the ocean where it's zero elevation. It's very beautiful. The moon or sun are very large, very distorted because of the atmosphere. But if you wait to the sun or moon's about a half a degree up, it's a much more smaller, and it's more defined, like it's not so distorted by the atmosphere. And so we think that they chose Hill because of that. The horizon has hills go up and down like the back of a snake, and the little dips, they actually took advantage of those, like the summer solstice, and that's what they lined a stone up with the, you have to have 2 points for an alignment, and they used three, actually. They used the horizon where the dip was, the stone itself, you watched the sunset over or sunrise over, and they actually had a point where you stood. The summer solstice sunrise is also pretty neat. The stone is asymmetrical. It has a slope to it. And if you look in the horizon about 4 or 5 miles away, the hilltop, two hilltops come together. They converge, and it's the same shape as the top of the rock. So they actually shape the stone to fit the notch in the horizon, which is natural. And they would watch the summer solstice sunrise go right over the notch and right over the stone. And it's similar to what you'd find in Scotland. This is what they call Bellacroix, I believe. And they also did something very similar to that in that Scottish site, another one called Tintra, the same kind of thing. They took advantage of what we call horizon features. So that's a very good question. I think it was accessible from the ocean, and also because of the astronomical alignments, because they had all that building material on top of the hill. All the top of the hill is a big, big bedrock outcropping.
Well, from what I understand, certainly you have found alignments in the settlement that are aligned with the solstices and equinoxes. Are there other specific star alignments that you have found in the settlement?
Yes, a doctor from Penn State, and he was with us for a few years. He passed away about 10 years ago, so his work wasn't quite complete, but he was looking at not only the pole star, but circumpolar stars or circumpolar grazing. They're the ones that just touch the horizon during the course of a night. And he found one of our 14-foot stones, which has fallen and broken into four pieces today. It's kind of a menhir because it's a long stone, and it has the same shape as the top of the summer solstice sunrise stone, kind of a slope to it. And it looks a lot like the European stones. You can see ours. You think you're looking at one in Europe or the shape of it. But it was stood up at one time, and it actually when during the course of a night, a star called Isa was a circumpolar grazing star, just a bright star that goes around during the course of the night, and would actually touch the top of that rock. And he thought it would forecast, I'm not sure which events it was, I'd have to go back into his data, but he was saying that this is not, it does happen in other astronomically aligned sites. So the other one we were looking at is possible helical sunrises. The Indian medicine wheels out west, like in Sheridan, Wyoming, there's Bighorn medicine wheel. It looks like a wagon wheel, and it has 28 spokes, which might be 28 days of the month approximately, 28 ribs of the bison. And it had little cairns that align with three different stars in a certain type of year, Sirius, I think it is Rigel, and Aldebaran. It would rise in the morning, and then the sun would come up just a few seconds later, and they call it occulting it. The sun is so bright that you lose the star, of course, because of the brightness of the sun just a few seconds after star rise. And these were forecasters of seasons, I guess. And so they did do that out there. There's other medicine wheels in Saskatchewan, Canada, and there are a couple other. Montana has a few others. But the one we watched out in Sheridan, Wyoming was pretty cool. It is also a summer solstice alignment, too. We have other stones that are on our property that may be used for that purpose, but that hasn't been that study has not been complete yet, unfortunately. What we did find just recently by using Google Earth was my son was looking at a couple stones on property, and we found there's a big stone that's located about a half a mile away. It is on the north climate. So you go from the center of the site to the north stone, and you continue, there's another very large stone about 600 feet further, and it was stood on end too, so that the north alignment continues out. We're not sure why they did that, but he took Google Earth, and he went on the summer solstice, and he went out, and it goes over that notch I mentioned before for the sunrise, that natural notch. But if you go 3,200 miles further, it goes over Stonehenge in England, right through, it has the three trilithons, it goes right through the center of two of them. So if you want to try that on your Google Earth, it's kind of neat. The opposite direction on the summer, it would be the winter solstice sunset, if you went opposite that, the alignment goes down into Mexico, right over Teotihuacan, and I believe it was the moon pyramid, goes right over the top of that, if you wanted to extend the line out. True south of our site is a effigy mound in Andover, Massachusetts. It looks like a turtle if you look down on it. It's these type of things exist elsewhere in the world, and to have them right in New England, and this one's right on our south alignment. And It's in a mag, and it's called Weird New England. They have a picture of it, beautiful photographs of this turtle mound, the effigy mound. They're not sure the age of it. It's prehistoric. But if you continue that line south, it ends up over Machu Picchu in Peru. So it's kind of neat that these alignments, some people call it the sacred geometry, I guess. And there's one that goes off our equinox sunrise that goes over the Azores, over the one of the pyramids that's in the Azores goes right over it, too. So you can try that with your Google Earth. There's something we just found out this year. We haven't had enough time to really go back and study it too much, but it was kind of amazing to us that these alignments go right off and continue and end up in Stonehenge or down in Mexico or in Machu Picchu. It's kind of neat.
Well, I guess that was one of my questions, Dennis, and certainly it's an interest of anybody that listens to Guardians of the Holy Grail, is one reason that they made Mystery Hill where it is today, because it's an area that does connect into this planetary grid of ley lines that connects all these sacred sites all over the planet.
Yes, it was really eye-opener for us when we saw that, you know, when we did that. And so I think more study has to be done on that, but it was amazing. It went right over, not next to Stonehenge, from what we can tell, or Machu Picchu or Teotihuacan or the Azores, but right over the top of the structures. And I don't know how accurate that Google Earth is. You know, that's something that's meant to be, I guess, looked at a little bit closer, but It was pretty amazing, and that was just something we looked at about 2 months ago, you know. So it's obviously people have to get in and do a little more study on that and find out more about that. But it was kind of a little bit of a shock to us when we saw that, to be honest with you.
Well, from the research you've done personally and the research of other people that have come through the site, what have you determined about the culture of these people, especially the religious, spiritual culture? Obviously, it appears as though some of these enclosures are like temples, and then you've got probably the biggest cut rock on the site seems to be a sacrificial stone. So what can you tell me about the ancient religion that they observed in this site?
Well, we do a comparative study of our site and other, you know, northeast sites as well as sites around the world. And when you look at a lot of the sites, like some of the 50,000 megalithic sites in Europe, they seem to be tombs, temples, and monuments. The people themselves lived in generally, we think, something perishable like wood or hide. And the sites themselves are pretty clean, like Stonehenge or any of the other sites. When they do an excavation, they usually find a few things, but not a lot, because they didn't leave their trash behind there. They weren't living right on the site. You wouldn't find what they call a trash heap or the middens there. And our site is, again, on a hill like most of these ancient sites, up high, it's elevated. And it seems to be pretty clean archaeologically again. The structures, a lot of work went into them. There's a lot of detail work like the oracle chamber. It has a chimney flue with stone louvers. It has a bed in there. It has a seat that was carved. It has a couple, I think, three or four closets inside the chamber. It has a couple carvings, one of a deer carving, one of an arrow. And it has two underground drains that keep the site, to keep that chamber dry. These drains, some of them run up to 75 feet in length. There were about 12 drains that were created because the hilltop was bare back then. When it rained, they had to drain the bedrock. It didn't have soil or trees or vegetation to soak up the water. So at the time the site was built, they engineered the drains first, and then they built the structures over them. And then we have another chamber called the Chamber in Ruins, and it had two windows. It has a doorway. It has like a hallway that you'd walk down, and next to it was another chamber, and the roof has collapsed. It's right near where the Patty's house was, so a lot of damage was done in that area. The chamber in ruins in 1964, and they were going to try to take the roof out of it and excavate the floor and find out if there's any artifacts and also look for an underground drain there because all the chambers have drains. But they weren't able to remove this top stone. It's close to 10 tons, almost 20,000-ton roof slab. And actually, there was another stone. There was two roof slabs. That was the biggest one. There was another one that sat on the edge of it. But that's where the two inscriptions were found. One was Libyan, and the other one was Phoenician. And the Phoenician one was a triangular-shaped stone. It was probably about a three-quarters of an inch thick and probably about 2 feet across. And it said, dedicated by the Canaanites. Dedicated to Belos, on behalf of the Canaanites. So it was like a sun temple, according to Barry Bell. So we have an idea that that structure was a temple, kind of confirming what we thought about the site as being a sacred site versus a living site. Some of the structures are kind of small to live in. They might have formed shrines. The only problem is we know that when the Paddies were there in the 1840s, at least half of the site was taken away. So we're looking at the skeletal remains of a much larger complex. The southern half of the site suffered the most damage in the quarrymen worked in that area. They were working their way north across the site and fortunately stopped right by a chamber we call the East-West Chamber. And that East-West Chamber looks like a galley grave you'd find over in Ireland or France or even up in Holland. And they always run east and west, 40 to 60 feet length, and that's what our chamber looks like. Next to it is a chamber we call the V hut because it's shaped like a V. If you look down at it, it has a big stone on top that serves as a roof. And this structure faces the southwest. And until my dad and I went over to Ireland in 1983 and spent a week just looking at some of the 2,000 sites, we only saw a few of the 2,000 megalithic sites. But the wedge tombs over there look a lot like our chamber, and they always face southwest, just like our chamber. So the size, shape, and orientation is very important. In another chamber called the Lilac Chamber, the south-facing chamber, looks like one in Goodwin's book, which he wrote in 1946, called The Ruins of Great Ireland in New England. And that structure was found in County Meath, Ireland, and it's called the Fugu. I think it's F-O-O-G-U or something like that. And the Fugu might have been used as a sweat house. That's what they think over there. And it looks a lot like our chamber. So there's a very close similarity of the architecture of those structures in Europe and some of the structures found on our site. The one I mentioned, the chamber in ruins, when I saw that, we went to France in 1984 and we visited Carnac. And besides seeing all the rows of stones, which are spectacular, and the Grand Desjumet here, which is a 60-foot long stone that was used as a lunar observatory, it was stood up as an obelisk. One big chunk of stone, almost 700,000 pounds, was dragged, I think about a mile or so, then it was stood on end, and today it's fallen and broken in like five pieces. But right next to it was a chamber, and I looked at it, and I said, my gosh, it looks just like the chamber in ruins, except the roof is still intact. It looks so much like our structure. So we think the site's a religious site, and the other sites in New England and the Northeast probably were used for that purpose also.
Well, when I was there with my wife and my dad, we sat down on one of the big rocks in the complex, and we kind of focused on, you know, who were the builders, and we were hoping we would, of course, get some visions, and or we would be told cosmically, you know, who were the original builders. Well, when I closed my eyes, I kept getting visions of Vikings coming through there. Later on, when we walked down to the visitor centers on the site, I realized, or found out rather, that Prince Henry Sinclair was near there, and one of his the people in his party, James Gunn, his grave, his marker there, known as the Westford Knight, just 18 miles away. And, of course, I was totally crestfallen by that because I'm a Templar Knight and I would have loved to have visited it. But, of course, Prince Henry, you know, he comes from the Viking tradition. And so I guess I'm wondering, is could Prince Henry and his group have visited there?
It's very possible. I think the site brought in people in the past because it is a very, you know, unusual place. Although we don't have any direct evidence at this time, and we are only about 18 miles away. In fact, the main road that goes by is called Route 111 and heads over towards the seacoast of New Hampshire. And in that direction, there's a couple of chambers, Plastow, New Hampshire, and Newton, New Hampshire. Some really interesting chambers, and if you head back to the west in the direction of Massachusetts, towards western Massachusetts, there's a couple more chambers along the way. And then when you get down into Westford, on the hill, it's where that carving was, and it's right by the side of a road, unfortunately, and road salt and wear and tear have caused some damage to the petroglyph, and it was recognized, I guess, by Frank Glenn, who was president of the Connecticut Archaeological Society. He and his daughter visited that back in the 1950s, and she was a little more curious than he was because they heard it was a an Indian chief carving, or carving made by Native Americans for an Indian chief, I guess. And as the daughter removed a little bit of the lichens and the mosses, I think, and cleared off some of the debris, they started seeing something that didn't look like that. And in fact, it looked more like a knight that appeared to them. And so that's when Frank Glenn really got interested, once he could see what it was, you know. And a gentleman named Frederick Pohl, back in the 1960s, did a lot of research on this, maybe in the 1950s. But I think it was around 1955 Frank Glenn first, recognized it may be something other than something the Native Americans might have done. But, yeah, Sir James Gunn and Sir Henry Sinclair and the Zeno brother, very fascinating tale of them coming over. Maybe he was, I guess, some people say he was Duke of Denmark and premier nobleman of Norway and Earl of the Orkney Islands and had a fleet of ships. And, yeah, his ancestry would have Viking blood for sure. He was, I guess, thought Norman and Norwegian and Swedish. I'm sorry, he was Scottish and French. So he would probably have some of the tales even in his family about the Viking voyages to this land to the west. Now, I'm not sure about this. I've read where one of his descendants married Christopher Columbus, and I thought that was fascinating too. Columbus does go up on a voyage to Ireland, and supposedly we saw where he went to a church and prayed in Galway, not too far from the Dingle Peninsula, where St. Brendan the Navigator, in about the 6th century A.D., made an expedition. Some people think he sailed around the Atlantic and saw the east coast of the Americas, of North America, I should say. But Columbus also goes up into Thule, I believe, Iceland, where the descendants of the Vikings still they're still living today, and possibly in a, you know, on a mission to obtain information from these people. You know, what was this land they found? And so there's a lot about Columbus that's very fascinating, including he tried to go to Greenland, I guess, and the ship got covered with ice. He decided a southern voyage would be more appropriate, I guess. And that's some of the things I've read about it. But Sir Henry Sinclair, that's a fascinating account, and he may have ended up in Nova Scotia first and then down in the, going up the Merrimack River, which we talked about before. And as you head west, you continue where the Merrimack bends and heads up towards Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire. He would have continued west for a little ways and left this carving in memory of Sir James Gunn, possibly, who may have died right there. And there is, right down the street in Westford, some sort of a stone enclosure that some people suggest could be something left behind by the St. Clairs. It has not been excavated. It looks like a kind of a rectangular-shaped compound. I think someday somebody's going to get in there and check that out. But you can visit the Knight Carving today, and you can go to the library in Westford, and you can actually see they have a nice little display on the Westford Knight and some of the history. And then at our site, we were given the fiberglass full-size cast by James Woodall, who passed away back in the late 90s. He was one of the big investigators of all these Northeast ruins. And James, his name so kind of goes down in history as one of the big investigators of these unknown structures, basically.
Well, I know that you've traveled to many of these other megalithic sites in the Northeast, and obviously there's so many of them there. It amazes me. Are the other ones that you've visited, are they as elaborate as the ruins in Mystery Hill, and do they date back date as far back as those ruins?
They haven't carbon dated every site because they haven't excavated every site to find out to find the evidence to carbon date like charcoal. Yeah, they number about 800, and our site's probably the largest complex in a given area of structures. There is one other one called Gunjiwamp near Groton, Connecticut, right near the Navy base. And the land it's on is about 200 acres, and it has all these stone structures and has carvings. And the carbon datings on that tend to put it back, I believe, around the 6th century A.D., so it's a newer site than ours. But it's almost 900 years before Christopher Columbus. And it may have some early origins to the site because they haven't excavated the whole thing and checked every, you know, every artifact and everything that they remain to be discovered, but it has chambers. A couple of them look a little bit like ours, like the Watch House, which is the first thing you'll see when you come to our site. It has a large glacial boulder with a structure built on the left side of it. Gunjiwamp has a very similar structure, and there are about 50 of those same structures in New England with a large glacial boulder with a structure built on the side of it. And Gunjiwamp covers a big area. we're very happy that to hear, I think it was last year, that one of the sites up in Vermont, and it's called, there's a South Woodstock site called Calendar One, and there's another one called Calendar Two. And it might be Calendar One, I forget which one it was just put in the National Register of Historic Sites. And that's a big thing. It's the very first one of these Northeast sites to ever get that recognition, both by the state. It has to go through the state, and then it has to go into the federal government for recognition. So it's a big red tape process, a lot of bureaucracy involved, and you have to do a, you have to kind of prove a number of things on the paperwork. And we've seen the paperwork before and how complex it is, but they actually recognize this structure as something important by the federal government. So we thought that was kind of neat. But these are all over the landscape, and if you go down into New York City, you go about an hour north in Westchester and Putnam County, right on the Hudson, there's about 200 sites in that locale alone. So that's a big area, and right near one of the biggest cities in the world, just up the river.
Well, with all this information and all these incredible sites in existence, how do you think that people can still say that Columbus discovered America?
Yeah, I think the evidence, and as time goes by, we keep the technology's getting better, more places are being discovered, more, and people are doing more research on just on history, going back and looking at history again. And like, for instance, the Gungeewon site, people say, well, maybe it's built recently, but in 1654, a gentleman named John Pynchon wrote to Governor Winthrop and said, what are these strange stone ruins? You know, and that's not exactly what, you know, I'm paraphrasing kind of, but the strong fort, or these stone structures, what are they? You know, and that was in 1654. But the new tech, you know, they have new technology. One of them is possibly when you carve a stone or when you break a stone open, the aging process begins in the stone, and they can look at it with a scanning electron microscope. This process is being developed now, like carbon dating was in the 1950s. And maybe someday we'll be able to take this, and because our stones are quarried off the bedrock, we might be able to take a sample of the stone, look at it in a scanning electron microscope, and we can get a rough date of when the stones were originally quarried or when a carving was made. But I think there's just so much evidence today. All these little pieces of the puzzle, it's not conclusive yet, but it looks like people were here before Columbus. We know the Vikings were here 500 years before the Columbus, and we know that Native Americans were already here going back well over 12,000 years ago. And today the Smithsonian Institute, the director of that, Dennis Stafford, has actually been at some of the meetings of a group called New England Antiquities Research Association, which was formed in 1964 by my dad. It's been going for, it's going to be close to 50 years. They have about just over 500 members all over the Northeast, and they have two meetings a year. They have news journals that put out. They have a nice website, NERA.org. And these people from the Smithsonian have been there, Bruce Bradley, Dennis Stafford, Betty Magus, who's very famous, and Ted Timrick, who does, documentaries for the Smithsonian and for PBS. And these people have been to these meetings, NERA. And years ago, they would have stayed way away from this group because they thought they're, you know, kind of crazy looking at these old stone ruins. But they didn't think these stone ruins meant anything. They were just historic, built a few hundred years ago and nothing to be bothered with. But they're coming back and they're starting to look at the evidence saying, hey, maybe there's another, maybe the answer isn't historic. Maybe these sites are ancient and prehistoric. So I don't think you can say that, Columbus discovered America. I think there are many waves of people coming across, DNA evidence, linguists. Linguistic evidence seems to indicate that. And then the structures, the place names, all the things we've mentioned so far seem to indicate people were going on boats around the world well before we gave credit for that.
So do you have any plans in the near future of what you're going to be doing with America's Stonehenge, or any more excavations or any more work on the site itself?
Yeah, we have... we'd like to continue the research. It's been going on since the 1930s. We would love to do some more excavations next to some of the stones that have fallen, some of the big, large monoliths. North Stone, when we excavated that in 1989 through 1991, we found a fire pit. And the fire pit was dated, and it dated to 650 AD. Somebody used it as a backstop. It didn't date the stone. It just shows that the stone was already there. The first feature was a stone was stood up at some time in the past. In about 650 AD, somebody built a campfire in front of it, and they used it as a backstop. And so the fire pit was a later feature. The stone was an earlier feature. If the stone had been put there by the Paddies, let's say, some people argue that the Paddies built the site, You would have disturbed the strata. The layers of soil were not disturbed, but they would have disturbed the strata, and they would have destroyed the fire pit because the fire pit was right up against the stone. So the first feature was the stone stood up, and then the fire pit was, you know, much, much later, probably around 650 AD. So we know the stone was standing there at least 1,300 years. But the May 1st alignment, we had the four cross quarter days, and the Celts also looked at these days as very important. In fact, more important than the four seasons, May Day, November 1st, August 1st, and February 1st. But if you go out to Mesa Verde in Colorado, Native Americans also had alignments with these cross quarter days. And at Cahokia Mountain State Park near Illinois, which is called America's Woodhenge, had a big wooden circle set up for the seasons and the cross quarter days. But the Celts honored these days, and we have like the May 1st stone. It's a 9-foot stone, and it's fallen, and I'd love to see that one excavated and someday stood up. And the equinox sunrise is also about 9 feet long, and it's fallen over. And then there's a stone that you would stand and watch it from, and that stone has fallen over too. And then the November 1st alignment, that has also fallen. So I'd like to see that. And we also have a chamber on top of a ridge that was probably destroyed by a hurricane in 1948. 10 years after the 1938 hurricane, a very bad hurricane struck the site, caused more damage, and this big tree fell down and collapsed the structure. That structure's never been studied. And so that's another structure we'd like to get in and, you know, open it up and see what's in it. So it's probably it has original material in it, perhaps. So we have plans for that. It's just a matter of getting the resources, the time, the people, and we hope something like that will, you know, continue indefinitely. There's only 1 acre of land that's been excavated. You could put all the test pits together, and that's since 1936. 1 acre, which is less than 1% of the hilltops actually been looked at. We've used ground penetration radar. We found a couple of interesting areas that we should look at. We found a couple of fire pits, and they, to the west of the site, there appears to be a big hollow place in what we thought was solid bedrock, and the radar seems to indicate it's a big hollow space in the ground. Now, whether it's geological or man-made, we don't know. But that's always, it's been 15 years we've been thinking of trying to get in there and dig that out. So that one, to me, is the most interesting, I think.
Well, America's Stonehenge is open all year round. I'm right about that, right? It's open all year round.
That's correct, yep.
And what time of the year would you recommend that visitors come by?
Well, the fall is usually really nice. The fall, the mosquitoes are gone, and it's really beautiful. Winter, we do snowshoeing, and right now, the nice thing about this time of year, again, is no mosquitoes. The air is usually pretty clear. Yeah, winter solstice is coming up in about a week and a half. And the leaves are off the tree, so you can actually see a lot more without the leaves. It makes it a nice time of year also. But we do stay open year-round. I think in summertime, that's when most of our crowds come, but I think the fall and winter are actually the nicest as far as actually seeing the site itself. You can see it so much more clear without all the foliage.
Well, thank you so much, Dennis, for coming on the show today. I'm just totally amazed at the knowledge and information that you have about America's Stonehenge and the other megalithic sites in the Northeast. I definitely plan to come back there again, and I know that my wife, my dad, and my stepmother, we'd all like to definitely come back there. It was just an amazing, amazing place, and such an eye-opener to believe that this place it appears to be created by an advanced culture, and all signs show that it's so incredibly ancient. It just amazes me that there aren't hundreds of thousands of people pouring in there every day. So it's a mind blower to me. So I'm hoping that with this interview and perhaps with other books and documentaries that come out around America's Stonehenge, that you'll definitely get a lot more exposure. And a lot more people will start showing up to see the place. So once again, thank you. And I think I'm going to be seeing you soon in the near future, maybe even next year.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for having me on your radio today. I really enjoyed talking with you and meeting your family last week. And hopefully we'll see each other soon. And I think a lot of people, if they knew about this, they'd probably be interested in visiting or reading about it or seeing it on a show, I think. You know, it's just that people are unaware of these sites, and we appreciate you for helping us with that.
Of course, of course. And what totally amazes me is I grew up in New Hampshire, and And I had absolutely no idea that your place was there. I would have definitely seen it when I was younger. I couldn't imagine there being a better educational tool to visit in my own state than yours. I would think that a lot of schools would be interested in taking day trips to see the place. It's such an incredible educational tool that way. But we'll definitely be back in the next year or two, and I look forward to seeing you then, Dennis. And
well,
once again, thank you so much for being on.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Mark. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Okay, well, that's our show for today, and we'll have another very interesting guest talking about another very interesting topic soon. And all you Grail hunters, keep in mind that the Grail that you're trying to find outside yourself is always within your own heart. So go there and find it. And bye for now.